Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Seth and Sean Sports Radio Show. Seth Kamen's not here, waiting to dial in right now. And Sean Palmer, who is apparently right here. And we have a plethora of things to talk about today. Plethora. Many, an abundant, numerous, all these things we have to talk about. It would be nice if our co-host got on the air, but he has been delayed. He was walking, so he asked me to start the show by myself. And lucky for me, because I have to tell you, I think that the first thing that Mr. Kamens would bring in, and if I have to paraphrase him, I'm thinking that the start of the show would be, so, Mr. Palmer, what do you think of Tebow Mania now in New England? What do I think of Tebow Mania now in New England? First of all, if you'd like to call in, 760-283-0846. 760-283-0846. And I hope that I am not going to be alone for the entire broadcast, because that means 59 minutes of you people just hearing my voice. Trust me, I don't like hearing my own voice for 59 minutes. I can't imagine you would. So call in and talk to me. 760-283-0846. So, getting back to Tebow Mania in New England. I have to tell you, I thought this was going to happen. I thought it was going to happen for many reasons. First of all, Urban Meyer, who is the coach of the Florida, who was the coach of the Florida Gators when there was Tim Tebow had played there and won the Heisman, is a good friend of Bill Belichick and has been a strong, adamant supporter of Tim Tebow for his entire career, in the ups and the downs, even when he was a Jet. So that's number one. Number two, the offensive coordinator on the New England Patriots is Josh McDaniel. Now, for those that don't remember, where did Tim Tebow have his greatest success? That was with the Denver Broncos, and the head coach there, the guy that drafted him, well, you could put two and two together, Josh McDaniel. So we have Belichick's, one of Belichick's best friends in Urban Meyer, and Josh McDaniel, his offensive coordinator, and probably going to be the successor to Bill Belichick at some point, whispering in his ear saying, you know, we got this guy Tebow. He could do a lot for our team. He's not going to take over for Tom Brady, but he's been tutored by Chris Wankie, the ex-quarterback with the Carolina Panthers and ex-Florida State. And he says that his mechanics are good, and Urban Meyer is saying he can succeed. Josh McDaniel has seen him succeed. We've all seen him succeed. But we've seen him succeed with a great defense in Denver, and that defense is definitely not New England. Even as much as I hate the Patriots, no fan of the Patriots could say that that team has a good defense. Even my mentor, Mark Rubin, could never, who is the most diehard Boston fan, would not admit, would not say that the Patriots have a good defense. In fact, they have a horrendous defense. Let's see if the front four with Chandler Jones and Vince Wilfork, who may go down as the greatest defensive player in Patriots history, at least to me he is, out of Miami, will be better than they were last year. They have basically the Rutgers secondary. But here we are, Tim Tebow. Oh, and it looks like our compatriot has joined us. Hold on a second. Let's see if we can get him. Mr. Kamens? Mr. Kamens. Mr. Kamens is back on the air. Now, truth or tell me truthfully, Mr. Kamens. First of all, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Now, truthfully,
did you miss me?
I had 4 minutes of total bliss.
That's about now, 3.5 minutes longer than most women have with you. Hey,
that's a bad call. Come on now. I did you a solid. 3.5 minutes of pure bliss. Now, here's my question. Were you or were you not going to open this show by saying, Mr. Palmer, Tebow Mania in New England? How do you feel about that?
Couldn't be more indifferent.
No, I think that's the way you would have opened it to me.
Yeah, no, probably not, because I don't even think it's worth this much discussion. I mean, the
only
thing I find funny.
I think it is.
We have NBA finals, NHL finals, and this is what you want to open with?
Well, I wanted to open with it because I really think that he's in, A, the ideal situation for him. B,
agreed.
When that came up on ESPN.com and I saw it, the first words in my mouth were, son of a bitch, Belichick did it again. Because no other coach in the NFL could have taken him on and even given a scienta, ooh, big word, scienta of a positive vibe in that, hey, this is the right guy. But Belichick, who is the best coach in the NFL, should have been the Jets coach, but that's another story. But the best coach in the NFL can do something with this, and if he can't, then no harm, no foul. Actually, the contract that came out today, which was released, is 2 years, no guaranteed money, which tells you exactly how much Tim Tebow was wanted around the league. Zero guaranteed money. So the Patriots can look at him through training camp and cut him and owe him nothing. They can go to 1 year, and if they love him, they can keep him for the minimum. If they hate him, they can cut him again for no money. And the kicker, and I don't mean kicker as in, like, with the foot, the kicker as to the joke, is that the guy that he replaced, Mike Kafka, was signed by Jacksonville today. So now if Tebow gets released, we know where he's going. He's going to replace Kafka, and then we have Bliss in Jacksonville.
Well, I agree. It is a logical fit. If there is a place that Tebow can, you know, the Tebow circus will not take precedence. It's in New England. He'll have a chance to learn from Brady, compete with Ryan Mallett for the backup job. Maybe he ends up as the number four tight end behind Gronkowski, Hernandez, and Gronkowski's biceps. You know, who the heck knows? But at the end of the day, he is a football player. And I'd like to, you know, and I, my feelings on all the hubbub that goes with him aside, you know, I think he can help a team. You know, well, I find it funny when they're up 31-0 in the third, and he comes in and throws a touchdown pass to Danny Woodhead over the Jets? Absolutely. I'll find it hysterical.
Uh-oh. But Woodhead's not on that team anymore.
Oh, that's too bad. Where is he now? You're saying ha-ha-ha-ha-ha, but you're still going to be down 31-0 to the Patriots, so that's okay.
But there won't be the butt fumble.
Who knows? Who knows?
Brandon
who the quarterback
Moore is
of the
no
Jets
longer there, and Mark Sanchez won't be playing quarterback.
Doesn't mean there couldn't be another butt fumble. Still my second favorite play of the last 5 years.
So let's move on to something else. Now, I was going to proclaim this the Seth Kamen Show, just Seth Kamen's Day, because the major event to me that happened this past week is strictly in your court, literally. Rafael Nadal, I didn't realize, has won like 10 Grand Slams. He's 28 years old, and he's won 8 on clay. That's unbelievable.
Is he possibly underrated? I believe his career record at the French, and this sounds like a joke, but I'm pretty serious about this. I believe his career record is 58-1. I think the only person he ever lost to was Robin Soderling a few years ago in the semis. And that was the year, of course, Federer won it all. He's not the best of all time. Simply because he's won 12 Grand Slams. He has a better than 500 record over Federer. In my mind, he needs to be a little bit more well-rounded in Grand Slams to kind of get the best of all time aspect.
So who's in this? I know we talk about this every week with different sports. Last week it was Floyd Mayweather, and today we're talking tennis. But all right, so who's in the discussion? Talk to me about the discussion.
The best male tennis players of all time, It's now better
female is even. I think Serena kind of wrapped that up this week. But okay,
she may very well have. I mean, her record. I think she has 16 Grand Slams, and she's won at least each of them at least twice. And she's going to play another few years, and I don't see anyone who's going to beat her on a consistent basis.
All right, let's go, man. Come on.
Okay, so you're looking at Rod Laver, who is the only player to win the Grand Slam twice in 1962 and 69. I think you're looking at Sampras. I don't think you're going to have McEnroe or Connors at that level. They didn't win all four. Even Sampras never won the French. I think you have Federer there. You have a guy like Bill Tilden, but that's in the 1940s. It's kind of hard to gauge. At the end of the day, if Nadal's body can hold up for another 3 or 4 years, which I don't think it will. I think he's 27, but he's an old 27. His knees cannot handle the hard courts anymore. But if he can get to that 15 or 16 Grand Slams and he wins, he has at least two wins in each of them. And I think he has two Australian, one U.S. and one Wimbledon, although I'm not 100% sure. I do know he has 8 French. I think he's in the discussion. He's probably in the discussion now. But I think if he can get two in each, I think that puts him right at the tippity top with Federer and probably above Federer.
Okay.
The difference is Federer has the most beautiful game of all time. Rafa's game is not beautiful.
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I mean,
yeah, okay.
The most elegant
game of all time.
Okay.
Roger Federer has the most elegant strokes of anyone ever.
Okay. And the guy that threw the hardest fastball in baseball is not necessarily the best pitcher, right? I mean, you don't have to be. You don't have to look the greatest to be the greatest.
I understand. And look, people argue that Federer is not the greatest of all time because the one French that he won, he didn't beat Nadal. He can't beat Nadal and clay. Well, the reality is nobody can beat Nadal and clay. Nadal is the greatest clay tennis player of all time.
Well, okay. So let me go. First of all, Nadal is 27 right now. Okay. He's won 12
right.
Grand Slams. He's a lefty, which I don't really think matters, but he's definitely the greatest lefty of all time. I mean, Federer is not a lefty. The last lefty, the next lefty, I think, would be McEnroe, right? I mean,
I don't know. I don't know who's righty and who's lefty. I mean,
Sampras wasn't lefty, so I mean,
no.
All right, so you're putting in the GOAT, the greatest of all time discussion.
He's in the pantheon.
Rob, so we're looking at, and Pro Football Talk is doing Mount Rushmores, but we're going in the circle here. So the circle is Roger Federer, Pete Sampras, Rafael Nadal, and Rod Laver, and Bill Tilden?
There's more. There's Don Budge. There's there's a few others that I can't think of off the top of my head. But that's
Roy Emerson,
that
perhaps?
I don't think I put – Emerson won a lot of his Grand Slams in a period where it was kind of a real –
All right, you're breaking up, buddy. You're breaking up. You got to stay in one place.
I don't know if I, even though Emerson won that many, I don't know if I would put him quite at that level. The question is Lendl there? Maybe, probably in the bottom tier of the top 10, you can argue the McEnroe and the Connors, but in my mind, the three best I've ever seen are Nadal, Federer and Sampras. And there's not much question about that. The argument of Rod Laver is a little bit before my time, so it's difficult.
Right.
Pancho Gonzalez, a little before my time.
And I can go with those. The concept that I have is that, or the questioning on this, is that Nadal is always going to get dinged because of his French Open, because he was so dominant on French and was not as dominant on the other services, correct? I mean,
yes.
If you're looking at it right now. But as far as I recall, Sampras was probably just as dominant on grass. Not grass, on hard court.
No, it was grass.
It was grass.
Sampras.
Right, it was grass?
Sampras was most dominant on grass, but he also won four or five hardcore, because he hardcore majors.
Okay, well, that would be
remember,
Nadal,
Sampras
too,
right? No, Sampras won 16 majors and won, I believe.
No, 14. 14 Grand Slams.
Is it 14? Okay. I want to say six or seven of them were Wimbledon.
Okay.
He never won a French.
Right.
Which, you know, is what it is. But that means he won six or seven other titles of the U.S.
Correct.
And Australian variety, which are both hard court.
Correct. So Nadal has won 12 and has won eight on clay.
On clay.
So that gives him four otherwise, right? So, I mean,
right.
I guess what I'm saying is, to me, I think that argument is foolhardy. I think it's irrelevant. I think the fact that you are so dominant on one surface, while you're still dominant and win on others, that shouldn't be taken against you. That should actually be a proponent.
No, but he's not dominant on the others. He's a top tier player. And I can easily put him in the top of the top. You can put him above Federer because he's got a better record than Federer. I believe Federer's all-around game at his best is better than Nadal's all-around game at his best. Federer is the best player I have ever seen.
At the top of his game?
Yes.
So you're not saying his career is the greatest. You're saying at the top of his game, from what you've seen, he's the best player that you saw.
No, Federer is the best player. Federer's career I would take over Nadal's.
Okay. You see, the way that I see this, I understand what you're getting at, where it's, are you looking at the prime, which is like the 2 or 3 year period where you are at your best, or the duration, which is where I'm going. And to me, and I know Sampras was dominant. I mean, I do. But to me, Sampras is more like a Tommy John or Don Sutton guy, where he had a long career and he won, but he wasn't a dominant player. I mean, people...
Completely disagree.
Okay.
I couldn't disagree more.
Okay.
Sampras was number one, I want to say, for 5 or 6 straight years.
Right.
He was dominant. He won seven out of eight Wimbledons.
Okay.
He was... So he certainly was dominant on grass. And of his 14 Grand Slams... He never won the French, so he was pretty dominant on hard courts. Now, the difference between the reason I think that Federer was a better player, if there was one match I could watch all time, it would be Federer versus Sampras on grass, because I have no idea who would win. None. I do believe that Federer's clay game was better. If Federer was probably at his best, the second best clay court player in tennis, he couldn't beat Nadal,
which
nobody can beat. Nobody has beaten Nadal, so that's not really, he lost in the finals, I want to say, 2 or 3 times to Nadal at the French. I think he was a better all around player. Nadal, while at that level, I don't think was as good on the hard courts or at Wimbledon. He was as good as he was as a clay court player. His second tier of grass and hard court was not as good for as long a period of time as Federer's was. And that may be because of his injuries.
Let's preface this, though. He's not done.
No, he's not.
He's 27 years old, and granted, it's an older 27, but he's not done. I mean, guys have made comebacks or gotten better as they've gotten older
in certain cases
as well.
Very, very rarely in tennis. The one noted exception that I can think of is Andre Agassi.
Of course, that was the guy I was going with.
Agassi's a little bit of a different situation. Agassi didn't come back from injuries.
Sure
Agassi
did.
Came
he had
back
a wrist
from
injury.
No, Agassi came back from indifference and laziness and drug use. when he decided he wanted to motivate himself, that was when Agassi's injuries were there, but it was not to the extent of what Nadal's have been. You know, Nadal was out for 7 months last year. Nadal seems every year to kind of fade by the U.S. Open. Although, and I don't think his game at this point on the hard courts is as good as an Andy Murray or a Djokovic or a Federer. I mean, I still think it's the four of them and everyone else, although all props to David Ferrer for finally making a final. But he doesn't seem to strike me as he's going to have the health. If he had the health for the next 4 to 5 years, then it's up in the air.
Well, let's look at it this way. He wins two more clays, okay? He wins two more Frenches. Now, granted, we know he's going to win the French. But let's say he wins two more Frenches. And he actually loses on clay. Okay, but he wins two more Frenches. So he's got 10. Okay, he wins two more on hard court. So two more on either hard court or grass.
Okay.
So that gives him 16.
Okay.
Okay? Which is one less than Federer. I think Federer's got 17.
Okay, whatever it is.
That's as dominant as you can get.
As I said, you know, I'm putting him in the top three players I've ever seen.
I know. And when you get to those top three players, you're splitting hairs.
Yeah. I mean, at worst, he goes down as the greatest clay tennis player of all time. A first ballot tennis Hall of Famer. I mean, not that tennis Hall of Fame has that much of a meaning per se, but he goes down in the pantheon.
Yep.
And I will say he has played in – what's also so great about him is he has been part of some of the greatest matches of all time.
Well, that was another thing I was going to bring up. I was going to bring that up because he's had a natural rivalry, correct? I mean, you can't discount people because they don't have natural rivalries, but you can certainly give them credit for their natural rivalries. So you have him with Federer, I mean, at this point, right? When you go back to Rod Laver, I don't remember, and granted, neither one of us was really a tennis fan or alive at that point.
Not even a twinkle in our parents' eyes.
No. He didn't have that.
No.
There was no guy there.
And that is something to be credited for, that he, in a good time, you know, Laver won these. Laver won these two Grand Slams in a time where, as I said, there was a separation between the U.S. and amateurs, between the professionals and the amateurs, where some of the best players in the world were amateurs.
Right.
Obviously, that doesn't come into play at this point. And, you know, the rivalry of him and Federer is as great as the rivalry between McEnroe and Connors, between McEnroe and Borg, Sampras Agassi. The caliber of tennis, I mean, you watch that Wimbledon final. It's probably the greatest match of all time.
Yep.
McEnroe.
That and Borg-McEnroe, yeah.
That was great. There's always other matches that you can put in. You know, my personal favorite match of all time is Sampras-Agassi at Sampras' last U.S. Open, where he won in four tiebreaks. Where I had people who I think ever watched a tennis match IMing me saying this is the greatest thing they've ever seen. Tennis.
By the way, I'd just like to point out we have now talked 15 minutes about tennis.
Well, this is what happens during baseball season when nobody cares what's going on in June.
But it's not just baseball season. We got a lot of crap that's going on here.
You want to extend the show a half hour?
No, I think we'll cut into an hour. But I'd just like to point out that this show is a little bit more diverse than just the four majors. We talked about boxing and soccer for half an hour last week. And here we are, tennis with 15. So if you'd like to call in and talk about any sport, you know what that makes us? We can go to the Octagon
much...
if you'd like. 760-283-0846. We can do it all. We can talk about bocce ball. Not that I think that there is a professional sport, bocce ball, but you never know. I mean, dodgeball on the Ocho, you never know. Anyway, so let's move on a little bit to you know, there was an ESPN, NBA TV documentary on Julius Erving, which I didn't get to watch yet. I'm actually DVRing it tomorrow. Where does he stack up, and is it possible to even stack him up based on the fact that he made so much of his career in the ABA?
You can't. There's no way for any of us to understand how good he was. People who, by the time he came to the NBA, he was still an all-star. He was still a Hall of Famer. But his best was in the ABA, playing for the Nets. I want to say the Virginia Squires. People rave about him the way people of our generation rave about Jordan. That unless you saw it and you were there, you couldn't quite understand it. And okay. It's probably the way people will rave about LeBron 10 years, 15, 20 years from now. He was a man, he was the first great jumper. The first truly, he revolutionized the dunk, which forever, whatever you want to call it. He was a guy who averaged 15, 20 rebounds a game. Yeah. Was a great player. It was not was probably the best, back and forth player you'll ever see. And again, this is well before our time. Always considered a gentleman on the court, real class act. Obviously, he's had one or two, little demons, but who hasn't? And someone who it's very difficult to rate because none of us saw him in his prime.
Well, I'd like to. That I read this week is that he still dunks once a year. He's 63 years old.
I saw that as well.
He dunked three times this year. And the story as it goes is that he had a 15-year-old, I think it was nephew, where he and two other 63-year-olds, along with two, 15-year-olds, challenged a group of 16-year-olds to a basketball game. He played. Now, he's 63 years old. I just hope I can walk at 63 years old, let alone play ball. And after the game, he went out and he dunked the ball three times. And his quote was, "Well, I guess I've taken care of the next 3 years." Are you kidding me? You're 63 years old and you're dunking a basketball. That goes well beyond anything I've ever thought of. But going back to we had a discussion last week about Jason Kidd, and we'll talk a little bit more about his coaching possibilities in a second. But we were remiss in one guard that we didn't talk about, and I wonder if you know who that is.
A guard we didn't talk about?
Well, we compared Jason Kidd to a lot of guards, especially
right.
His contemporaries in the last 20 to 25 years. We missed one.
I don't know who.
Is he better than Isaiah?
No.
Why not? Now, is an underrated player. I do. I think when people talk about Isaiah, they say, okay, he wasn't on the dream team, so he really wasn't that good and stocked it. But there was a whole lot of politics that went on with that.
Yeah, he wasn't on the dream team has nothing to do with anything. He wasn't on the dream team because Michael Jordan said he wouldn't play.
Agreed, but what I'm saying is people have a perception because he wasn't on the dream team that he was not as good a player as those players that were on the dream team. Would you take Stockton over Isaiah?
No.
Okay, and that just proves my point. So people that from the generation after ours that say, hey, he wasn't on the dream team, but John Stockton was, so he must have been better than Stockton, or Stockton must have been better than him, you say that would be a fallacy.
Yeah. Isaiah, excuse me. Stockton was a very, very good player and a Hall of Famer. Stockton was also a product of a system. Isaiah was as good a leader as you would want for a team. A great scorer, a great clutch scorer. Scored 41, I want to say, in game 6 of the 88 finals, which they lost to the Lakers with a sprained ankle. One of the greatest performances you'll ever see. Led a team that was hated to back-to-back championships. Good defensive player. Great passer. Probably is a bit underrated, not only because of that, but because of how he's presented as a front office executive.
Oh, he's presented as an idiot.
Yes. And, that he collapsed the CBA. And
he collapsed the Knicks for 5 years.
Exactly. So the reality, it wasn't like he was a big, Detroit, while not a small market, in a sports capacity, it's a big market, but it's a segregated big market. You know, it's not something that either the East Coast or West Coast are paying a lot of attention to be perfectly honest. And but in my mind, he probably goes down as the third or fourth greatest point guard of all time. I mean, Magic is one. Oscar Robertson would probably be two. There may be a third, which I can't think of off the top of my head. But I would probably have him third, maybe fourth. He's that good. He was that good in his prime.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. I think he has become an underrated. He's become, in the course of time, an underrated player. And I think a lot of it actually does have to do with the fact of his omission from the Dream Team. I really do. But that's just one man's opinion. So moving on from that to Jason Kidd, the coach. Really? Jason Kidd, the coach? Now, we have a model of this in Mark Jackson becoming a coach right after he was,
No, he wasn't. Mark Jackson didn't be
not
Mark
right
Jackson
after
was
a player, but I meant no coaching experience whatsoever. You have Lindsey Hunter that went on to be a coach in Phoenix with no coaching experience whatsoever. Now, the key to these guys, at least for Mark Jackson, was that he had a great assistant, Mike Malone, who is now the coach of Sacramento. And now you're looking at Jason Kidd coming to New Jersey, perhaps, and bringing Lawrence Frank, the ex, which is ironic considering he is the ex-coach of the New Jersey Nets, as an assistant.
Are you going to keep calling them the New Jersey Nets?
No, I did, didn't I? The Brooklyn Nets. Well, they would say, were the New Jersey Nets when he was the coach?
Yes, they were. And they took them to back-to-back championships.
Is this a solid move? Are you sold on this move?
Not even remotely. Mark Jackson, I don't think this is an era where you can have an athlete go directly from being a player to a head coach. Assistant, yes. Go to announcer. I think you need to see things from an external view before you can become a head coach. I don't think Jason Kidd has that. Does Jason Kidd strike you as an X's and O's maestro?
No, but that's why he brings in Lawrence Frank.
I understand that. Does he strike you as a great motivator?
I don't know. What he did with the Knicks this year was kind of impressive. I mean, the way that he turned them around, at least in the sense that he got them to play together. I mean, he was a glue guy. And I think that now the problem that I have, and this has been said numerous times by different people, is the fact that when you make mistakes as a player and you're a superstar, things are overlooked. Such as the problems with his wife and the DUI that he had last year. When you're a coach and you're a fungible commodity, which is basically what you are as a coach because you're not on the salary cap, you can be fired at any time, you don't have the Players Association backing you up, you make those mistakes, you're gone. So is it a concept that Jason Kidd, and yes, I am quoting Dwayne Johnson, The Rock at this point, you first have to learn to know your role and shut your mouth. And that is the transition between player and coach. And I'm agreeing with you. I don't think that you can go straight into it. Even Lindsey Hunter, I believe, was an assistant coach first.
He was either that or was a director of player personnel. He was something along those lines. I'm Brooklyn. What'd you say?
I said, so was Chicken Del Negro.
Do you just call him Chicken Del Negro?
It's funny. When I was a kid, when we were playing NBA 95 back in college, for some reason we called him Chicken Del Negro. And I always have called him Chicken Del Negro. It has nothing to do with anything, but Vinny Del Negro will always be to me Chicken Del Negro.
Sean Palmer's, ladies and gentlemen. if I'm the Nets, I jump on Brian Shaw personally. But the Nets want to make a splash, and I'm sorry.
Does that offense work? Does the triangle work with this team?
I don't know. I honestly don't. But I think, you know, Shaw, while a Phil Jackson disciple, I'm not convinced he's going to run a straight triangle offense. You know, he hasn't. He's been now for team with, I guess he was in it with Indiana last, where they don't run the triangle. And, you know, I think he's a guy who's put in his time. I think he's been influenced by a variety of coaches and systems. And he's someone eager for the shot. And, you know, I'm much more in favor of a new coach than the rehashing of someone who's been around 2, 3, 4 times. I don't mind someone getting a second shot, but after the second shot, you know, the third and fourth, the retreads to me are not, you know, they're not really something that's going to bring something to the party. I think Shaw is a logical pick.
I don't disagree with you. I mean, I think Shaw deserves a shot. I think that he has been, unfortunately, being a disciple of Phil Jackson ruined his shot in L.A. I think that the fact that he was too close to Phil really did hinder the fact that he was going to get that job. I thought that job was his. But we'll see. I mean, I do think he's the right choice in New Jersey. Sorry, in Brooklyn. Man. Or if he becomes free, Doc Rivers. But they've already asked for permission and they said no. Doc Rivers has yet to commit to the Boston Celtics because from what everybody is talking about, he'll figure it out once Kevin Garnett figures out what he's doing because he doesn't want to sit in for another major rebuild. And I don't blame him. I mean, there was an interesting article, and we'll move on to the NBA Finals now. Interesting article on SI.com about Ray Allen. And I think Ray Allen's probably the best shooter of the last 20 years. Not sure if you agree, but I believe he is. Best pure shooter. And the concept is Ray Allen doesn't have a legacy to leave because he doesn't associate himself by leaving Boston when he did. Much to the same way as I believe your LeBron argument shapes up with Ray Allen, is that he doesn't have when he retires, hey, I fit with this team. And he doesn't leave a legacy. In fact, he may be one of the few NBA players that makes the Hall of Fame on the first or second try and doesn't get his jersey retired by anybody.
I read the same article. And that was actually very well done.
Agreed.
And I think it's an interesting point. I never really gave it much thought, to be honest. But it makes sense. You know, Seattle, he was there, but...
Well, Seattle's,
you know, there was
no longer there, so that doesn't help.
Right. Milwaukee, you know, nobody really leaves a legacy in Milwaukee, unfortunately, except for Sidney Moncrief. And he, you know, the Celtics, and the sad part is if he stayed, they could have made a run this year. If Rondo had stayed healthy. And now he's a bit player in Miami in a town where they don't really care about basketball. I'm sorry to our Florida listeners. You don't. Unless you're good, you don't care.
And even more so, he's only going to be there for 2 or 3 years. It's not like he's going to create a legacy in Miami. I mean, the legacy that he made, if there was one, was in Seattle, where I believe the average goes to like 26 points a game. I mean, he was a stud in Seattle. Unfortunately, the team no longer exists, and when you go 5 years for each team, it's kind of, I mean, I want to say it's a little bit like Reggie Jackson, but Reggie had, I think it was 6 or 7 years with the Oakland Athletics, so that would go a little bit more. And, of course, he was the stir that stirred the drink in New York. So he had a little bit more of a influence. Ray Allen was the top player in Seattle, but I'm not sure he was ever the top player in Milwaukee with Glenn Robinson there. And we sure know he wasn't the top player in Boston. So he may be one of those Hall of Famers that may never have been the number one guy anywhere.
Yeah, but you know what? That was his decision. I mean, to be fair, he probably never had the opportunity. In Milwaukee, I disagree. You know, the team with Cassell and Robinson and him were, you know, he was the best player on the team, but it's just, it's not a team that left a great legacy anywhere. They never made it. I don't know if they ever made a conference finals. They certainly didn't make
out of the first round. They never made it out of the first round in that team.
Really? That surprised me. I thought they had 1 year with against Philly. They made the semis.
Okay, I may be wrong, but I don't believe they made it out of the first round.
So, I think it's just one of those situations. But, you know, he certainly wouldn't have gone down the pantheon greats in Boston. And I actually agree with you. He's the best shooter probably I've ever seen. There's a couple names that come to mind, but he's if it's not him, he's right there. So,
this is what it is.
He forfeited that legacy the second he went to Boston. And that was fine. You know, they did that, and he would have gone down as a Celtic, which is not the worst way to go down.
Well, I think the interesting thing is he was beloved in Boston not only because he was a Celtic, was because he was a Husky too. I mean,
right? He went to UConn. Sure.
Right, and he won a title, I believe, at UConn.
No, he did not.
No, it was Rip Hamilton. Sorry. Yeah. Wow. Okay, I'm dating myself because I was in college when Ray Allen was. Actually, both of us were, but needless to say, I saw him at the Dome, and he was just as good a shooter then as he is today. Ray Allen will be a Hall of Famer, at least to me, he's a Hall of Famer. So the question is, I don't think he's a first ballot Hall of Famer, but he's definitely he's the best shooter that I've ever seen, and that may change with Stephen Curry, but he's definitely the best shooter right now. So that gives us a good segue to the NBA Finals. And when you said one day somebody will say you had to see LeBron in order to believe what LeBron could do, that block against Splitter was as good a defensive play as I've ever seen.
It's a little bit harder for me to gauge. I did not see the game live. So I only saw it by the time I got home. The game was in the fourth quarter. So, and it was already a blowout. So I didn't see it live. I've seen the replays. I think you have to see something in the context of a game to really feel the greatness of it. I mean, obviously it was a pretty amazing play. But LeBron is a man child. We all know that.
Yeah, that basically ended any run that San Antonio was going to make. I mean, that was as deflating a play as I've seen in a very long period of time on a basketball court. Because you got a power forward center going up for a dunk with nobody in front of him, and all of a sudden you have the equivalent of a small forward who's probably a little bit bigger than the average small forward, but putting up his hand and saying no, and no foul, just all ball. I mean, unbelievable play. And you're right, you have to take it in the context of the game. In the context of the game, that was unbelievable. I could not believe that when it happened. It was that good of a play.
Well, I'm not a big fan of a First Take, the show on ESPN. I'm not even remotely close to a fan of the show. But I did see part of it today because I was unfortunately home for personal reasons. And I had it on in the background. And they had an interesting question. From an all-time capacity, which is a better big three? Miami with Bosch, Wade, and James, or San Antonio with Duncan, Parker, and Ginobili?
I'd love to hear your thoughts on this first, given your propensity for not giving LeBron James enough credit.
I think it's Miami. I think it's extraordinarily close. But I think the upside of Parker, well, we've kind of forgotten about what the upside of Bosch was. But remember, Bosch was a 20-10 guy. Now he's a 20-10 guy with a team that was never competitive from a championship capacity. But to me, and the idea of picking between the best of Wade, the best of Duncan, and the best of James is impossible. Duncan goes down as a top 7 to 8 Hall of all time. James can be, from a player level, can be at that as well. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how to rate him because of what he did, but I certainly don't discriminate against his talent.
No, I understand that. I think when you look at this, are you looking at it again through the prism of the best that they were, or are you looking at them over duration of time? Because if you're looking them over duration of time, now granted, the Spurs haven't been in the finals for 7 years. They're a much better triple over the duration of time. Because seven years ago, these were still the same three guys.
Right. No, I'm looking at it from an individual.
One of them got better and two of them got worse. But they're still the same three guys.
Well,
I'm not sure if you look 7 years down the road that this – first of all, I'm not sure that the three Heat guys will be together. In fact, I'm almost sure they won't. And if they are, even if you take them the next 5 years because they've been together for three, you're not going to get the same quality of play.
No, but from it's as I said, it's a very difficult question. But the difference is, it is very difficult for me to make a fair determination on Manu Ginobili. I've never watched him. You know, I don't watch the Spurs on a day-to-day basis. His best, you know, a lot of his best, where he played. First of all, he started his career, of course, in Argentina, and so a bit of his prime was there. And then he was in a system where it was quite, you know, it was difficult for him to be the number one guy because you had Duncan. Now, his ego allowed it for that, where he didn't need to be a guy. But Popovich has said that he would have scored 30 points a game in another system.
I believe that.
I do, too.
Absolutely, I believe that. I believe when you look on the international stage when Manu played in the Olympics, outside the U.S. team, he was the best player in the world.
Yeah, it's him or Nowitzki.
I think Manu is actually a better player than Nowitzki.
Well,
I think Manu is a better – they're different players. But if I'm starting a team, I'm taking Manu over Nowitzki.
Fair.
I just think he's a more complete player.
The difference to me would be that when it's all said and done, Dwayne Wade is probably a top five all-time shooting guard. Again, this is from an NBA perspective. Manu, whether it was based upon the system he played in, I would not have had it at that level.
No, agreed. I completely agree. But was Dwayne Wade a top five? And this is where my dilemma comes in with these guys. And this is where your dilemma comes in with LeBron. Is Dwayne Wade a top five shooting guard with LeBron James? Or is he a top five shooting guard when he didn't have LeBron James? Because since LeBron came over, I haven't seen that top five all-time shooting guard except for a couple of games here and there.
Yeah, you're probably right. You know, he was top five before, which is what the whole frustration was, why James came over in the first place.
Kevin McHale on a different team, does he score 28 points a game? Because I'm thinking he probably does.
Probably.
I'm thinking Robert Parrish scores 25 a game. I'm thinking Dennis Johnson.
No.
Well, maybe not
Robert
Parrish.
Parrish would have been a 16-10 guy wherever he played.
Okay, so let's say Dennis Johnson. Okay, Dennis Johnson was a 20-point scorer with Seattle.
Yes.
And then he came over and he averaged 13-6 and took a back seat. I mean, yeah, all these guys, I understand your frustration with the big three, is that they toned down their levels because they became, for lack of a better term, system players. Now, it's a great system, but they're still system players within the three of them. My question with, well, not even question, but my comment with LeBron is he's gotten better. That's the difference. I don't think he took a back seat. In fact, I think he took control of the whole damn car. So
I agree. I mean,
anyway,
LeBron's, yeah, I mean, look, LeBron, as I said, I've never blamed LeBron for leaving. Never have. I just blamed him for where he went. You know, he was, and that's not the discussion for today. And probably will never be our discussion again.
In 15 years when he gets into the Hall of Fame.
Right, and we'll still be doing this radio show. Still
no,
talking about the girl that we're dating.
Some other mechanism, maybe, I don't know, George Jetson from a suitcase or something like that. At that point.
Fantastic.
FaceTime.
So
we've totally gone 50 minutes without saying anything about the Stanley Cup Finals, which start tomorrow. And we haven't talked one iota about the fact that it's 1-1 in the Spurs series. And are you? So let's take those very briefly in kind. Are you surprised that it's 1-1?
No, I figured it would be.
Okay, so your prediction of 6 games predicated on the Spurs taking game 1.
Yeah, I honestly think, and this is going to sound strange, I think whoever wins this game tonight wins the series.
Okay.
I think whoever is up 3, I don't think either team is going to win being down 3-2 going back to Miami. I think everyone is under the consensus that this series is going back to Miami. And I think whoever wins this will probably be up 3-2 when they leave, and I think that team will win the title.
Okay. I'm going to stay with Miami in 6.
I'm not changing my vote. I mean,
No, I understand. I was very impressed with what San Antonio did. I definitely didn't think that they'd win game 1. I thought they might have won game 2, but not game 1.
Yeah, that's how I would have seen it all.
But I'll tell you, I was damn impressed by what Miami did in game 2. I mean, that's as thorough a shellacking as I've seen in a long time in the second half. Because I know you didn't watch the game, but the first half was very close. In the second half, it seemed like Miami just put their foot on the metal, and then it was gone. And it was all gone. So, okay, we were trying to get Keegan Reed, our NHL superstar, on the show tonight to give us a Stanley Cup prediction, but he had a family event. So it's left to the two minions of Keegan, and that would be myself and Seth, who both know probably 1/10 of what Keegan knows about the NHL. So we have the Stanley Cup that you predicted, kind sir. And I will give you all sorts of credit for this. You predicted Chicago and Pittsburgh. And we don't have Pittsburgh.
So I'm not quite sure where you were going with that.
Oh, I'm not giving you any credit whatsoever. I was just making
a
mockery.
Fun of me.
So we got Chicago and Boston. The dreaded Bruins. The Bs. And where do you see this going? Game 1 tomorrow night.
Game 1 is actually tonight, I thought.
Oh, game one, no. Game 1 tomorrow night.
Oh,
Wednesday.
I was going to say, today would have been a great night of sports if it was
no,
NHL, NBA.
No, that's why it's tomorrow night, my friend. That's why it's tomorrow night. It's Wednesday, Saturday, Monday, Wednesday, Saturday, Monday.
Okay, I don't need the regurgitation of dates.
No. That's the schedule. Wednesday, Saturday,
no,
Monday, Wednesday, Saturday, Monday.
I would let, you know, I had Pittsburgh winning it all, so it wasn't exactly like taking Chicago not to win this would be going off the bandwagon. This is as far as I had them going, and it's as far as I have them going now. Boston just seems to be playing on a different level. I mean, sweeping Pittsburgh is one hell of an accomplishment. Tua Rusk has been phenomenal in goal. The team, you know, they don't have the overwhelming talent, but they're so deep. They seem to find a way. And I like them in a pretty competitive, you know, 6-game series.
Okay. I'm going to go against you, probably because I hate the Bruins and everything that goes with Boston still. So, I would like to say that I was there the last time the Bruins won the Cup and celebrated outside of the Garden. So, I'm going to take Chicago. Chicago looks like they are finally clicking on all cylinders, especially in that overtime game because they very much, and I'm not sure if you watched it, L.A. came back with 8 seconds left, which was one of the prettier goals I've ever seen. And the only time I've ever
seen it. I don't know if I'd put it, I don't know if I'd quite put it at that level, but I saw the goal live.
Well, it was one of the better design plays, let's put it that way, even if it wasn't a pretty play. When I was 7 years old, the Islanders called a timeout with 5 seconds left. I looked at my brother, I said, Trottier is going to draw this back to Potvin. Potvin is going to shoot and score, and we're going to win the game. That's exactly what happened. It's the only other time I've ever seen a timeout with less than 15 seconds to go, and it actually worked. And Chicago definitely could have said, enough, we're not going to do this, and folded. No, they didn't. They came back. So, anyway, so we got 5 minutes to go. I'm going to go first, give my co-host a little bit of time. And first, I'd like to thank all the new listeners. We have a couple of newbies out there that are listening, one that hails from Florida. So thanks for tuning in. Another couple from New York, thanks for tuning in. We always like new fans. Next week, give us a call at 760-283-0846. Now, for my, I guess you can call it my spanking of the day.
Hey-o.
Chad Johnson. What are you doing? For those that did not hear, Chad Johnson was brought up before the judge down in Florida on a probation. He violated his probation, didn't check in with the probation officer. And the judge, who happens to be female, said to him, Mr. Johnson, how do you think your attorney is doing? He goes, I think my attorney is doing a very good job. And then proceeded, and this is a male attorney, then proceeded to slap him on the ass in the middle of the courtroom, in which the whole court started laughing. Now, so the judge proceeded to give him 30 days in the brig, 30 days in jail, instead of just walking out. Now, did the judge basically do more than she should have? Did she overreact? Absolutely. Come on, you gave him a little fanny tap. We all do that. But if you're Chad Johnson or Chad Ochocinco or whatever the hell you are at this point, slow your roll. You're in the courtroom. Have some respect for what the courtroom stands for. Take your medicine and move on. Now you get to sit there for 30 days and figure that out. Seth, you're up.
I disagree a little bit. I really, and maybe it's because I'm not an attorney, I really didn't think it was that big of a deal.
No, he shouldn't have been put in jail. I said she overreacted.
What do I have? Well, there's, you know, we always hear about, you know, these, everyone is now trying to be the next big thing, making the next outlandish statement, making the guarantees on things. And there's a guy I had actually never heard of in Charlotte. Excuse me, for the Carolina Panthers, Greg Hardy.
50 sacks.
Yeah. He's decided that he is going to get 50 sacks this year. So that's a sack. It's about a sack a quarter. people wonder why I just shake my head when athletes talk. Why, when I deal on Back Sports Page, I've done a bunch of interviews in the past, although I now give them out to the writers when we get them. We actually just posted one on Maurice Jones-Drew. I encourage everyone to check it out. This is why I don't really like doing the interviews anymore, because I hear stupid crap like this. Deacon Jones, we forgot to kind of eulogize last week. Probably the greatest sack artist of all time. And to be fair, his numbers would have been significantly higher if he was in a generation where they count sacks. Or I think they kind of brought in the statistic halfway through.
Hey, Seth.
You know, people just...
Seth, we're going to talk about this next week because we really have to go, so we're going to go play Madden and get Hardy his 60 sacks.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. So for Seth Kamens, this has been Sean Palmer, backsportspage.com. Check it out. We'll talk to you next week.
Good night, everybody.